Test for English Majors, 2002, Grade 8, Paper 1, Part 1, Listening Comprehension. In sections A, B, and C, you will hear everything once only. Listen carefully, and then answer the questions that follow. Section A, Talk. Questions 1 to 5 refer to the talk in this section. At the end of the talk, you will be given 15 seconds to answer each of the following 5 questions. Now, listen to the talk.
The first era in American urban history extended from the early 17th century to about 1840. Throughout those years, the total urban population remained small, and so were the cities. At the first federal census in 1790, city dwellers made up nearly 5.1% of the total population, and only 2 places had more than 25,000 inhabitants. 50 years later, only 10. 8% of the nation's population fell into the urban category, and only one city, New York, contained more than 250,000 people. Largely because of the unsophisticated modes of transportation, even the more popular places in the early 19th century remained small enough that people easily walked from one end of the city to the other in those days. Though small by modern standards, these walking cities, as it were, performed a variety of functions in those days. One was economic. Throughout the pre-modern era, this part of the urban life remained so overwhelmingly commercial that almost every city owed its development to trade. Yet city dwellers concerned themselves not only with promoting agricultural activities in their rural areas, they also collected and processed goods from these areas and then distributed them to other cities. From the beginning then, and increasingly in the 18th and early 19th centuries, cities served as centers of both commerce and simple manufacturing. Apart from the economic functions, the early cities also had important non-economic functions to play. Since libraries, museums, schools, and colleges were built and needed people to go there to visit or to study, cities and the larger earlier towns, with their concentrations of population, tended to serve as centers of educational activities and the points from which information was spread to the countryside. In addition, the towns with people of different occupational, ethnic, racial, and religious affiliations became focuses of formal and informal organizations, which were set up to foster the security and to promote the interests and influence of each group. In these days, the pre-industrial city in America functioned as a complex and varied organizing element in American life, not as a simple, homogeneous, and static unit. The vitality of these early cities was reinforced by the nature of their location and by the process of town spreading. Throughout the pre-industrial period of American history, the cities occupied sites on the eastern portion of the then largely undeveloped continent, and the settlement of countryside generally followed the expansion of towns in that region. The various interest groups in each city tended to compete with their counterparts in other cities for economic, social, and political control, first of nearby and later of more distant and larger areas. And always there remained the undeveloped regions to be developed through the establishment of new towns by individuals and groups. These individuals and groups sought economic opportunities or looked for a better social, political, or religious atmosphere. In this sense, the city still helped the development of the successions of urban frontiers. Well, this kind of circumstance made Americans one of the most political and self-conscious city-building peoples of their time. It did not result in a steadily urbanizing society in the sense that decade by decade, an even larger proportion of population lived in cities. In 1690, an estimated 9 to 10% of American colonists lived in urban settlements. A century later, that is, the end of the 18th century, though 24 places had 2,500 persons or more, city dwellers accounted for only 5.1% of the total population. For the next 30 years, the proportion remained relatively stable, and it was not until 1830 that the urban figure moved back up to the level of 1690. In short, as the number of cities increased after 1690, they sent larger numbers of people into the countryside. Then they returned. Nonetheless, the continuous movement of people into and out of the cities made life in the many but relatively small places lively and stimulating.
Section B, interview.
Questions 6 to 10 are based on an interview. At the end of the interview, you will be given 15 seconds to answer each of the following five questions. Now, listen to the interview.
I'm talking to Janet Toms, who has spent many years negotiating for several well-known national and multinational companies. Hello, Janet.
Hello.
Now, Janet, you've experienced and observed the negotiation strategies used by people from different countries and speakers of different languages. So before we come on to the differences, could I ask you to comment, first of all, on what such encounters have in common?
Okay, well, I'm just going to focus on the situations where people speak English in international business situations.
I see. Now, not everyone speaks English to the same degree of proficiency, so maybe that affects the situation.
Yes, perhaps, but that's not always so significant. Well, because, I mean, negotiations between business partners from different countries normally mean that we have negotiations between individuals who belong to distinct cultural traditions.
Oh, I see.
Well, every individual has a different way of performing various tasks in everyday life.
Yes, but isn't it the case that in a business negotiation they must come together and work together to a certain extent? I mean, doesn't that level out the style of differences somewhat?
Oh, I'm not so sure. I mean, there are people in the so-called Western world who say that in the course of the past 30 or 40 years, there are a lot of things that have changed a great deal globally. And then, as a consequence, national difference has diminished or got fewer, giving way to some sort of international Americanized style.
Ah, I heard that. Now, some people say this Americanized style has acted as a model for local patterns.
Maybe it has, maybe it hasn't. Because, on the one hand, there does appear to be a fairly unified, even uniform style of doing business. Certain basic principles and preferences, you know, like time is money, that sort of thing. But at the same time, it's very important to remember that we all retain aspects of the national characteristics. But it's actually behavior we're talking about here. We shouldn't be too quick to generalize that into national characteristics and stereotypes. It doesn't help much.
Yeah, you mentioned Americanized style. What's particular about this American style of business bargaining or negotiation?
Well, I've noticed that, for example, when Americans negotiate with people from Brazil, the American negotiators make their points in a direct, self-explanatory way.
I see.
Well, the Brazilians make their points in a more indirect way.
How?
Let me give you an example. Brazilian importers look at the people they are talking to straight in the eyes a lot. They spend time on what, for some people, seems to be background information. They seem to be more indirect.
And then what about the American negotiators?
An American style of negotiating, on the other hand, is far more like that of point-making. First point, second point, third point, and so on. Now, of course, this isn't the only way in which one can negotiate. And there's absolutely no reason why this should be considered the best way to negotiate.
Right. Americans seem to have a different style, say, even from the British, don't they?
Exactly. Which just goes to show how careful you must be about generalizing. I mean, how else can you explain how American negotiators are seen as informal and sometimes much too open? For, in British eyes, Americans are direct, even blunt.
Is that so?
Yeah. And at the same time, for the British, too, German negotiators can appear direct and uncompromising in negotiations. And yet, if you experience Germans and Americans negotiating together, it's often the Americans who will be too blunt for German negotiators.
Fascinating. So people from different European countries use different styles, don't they?
That's right.
Okay, so what about the Japanese, then? I mean, is their style different from Americans and Europeans?
Oh, well, yes, of course. Many Europeans know the extreme politeness of their Japanese counterparts, the way they avoid giving the slightest offense, you know. They are also very reserved towards people they don't know well. At the first meetings, American colleagues have difficulties in finding the right approach sometimes. But then, when you meet the Japanese negotiators again, this initial impression tends to disappear. But it's perhaps true to say that your average Japanese business person does choose his or, more rarely, her words very carefully.
So can we say that whatever nationality you're dealing with, you need to remember that different nationalities negotiate in different ways?
Well, it's perhaps more helpful to bear in mind that different people behave and negotiate in different ways, and you shouldn't assume that everyone will behave in the same way you do.
Right. This is definitely a very useful tip for our businessmen who often negotiate with their overseas partners. Okay, Janet, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Section C, News Broadcast. Question 11 is based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 15 seconds to answer the question. Now listen to the news. The first International Tibetan Traditional Medicine Conference will be held July 15th through 17th in Lhasa, capital city of the Tibet Autonomous Region. China's Ethnic Medicine Institute, Tibetan Health Bureau, and Tibetan Medical College will co-host the conference. The conference has received more than 500 research papers from China and abroad. The organizing committee primarily selected 290 articles to be discussed at the conference. More than 50 foreign guests from the United States, Russia, Britain, India, Germany, France, Italy, and Nepal will attend the meeting. The Chinese mainland was sending a delegation consisting of 250 Tibetan medicine experts to the conference.
Questions 12 and 13 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 30 seconds to answer the questions. Now, listen to the news. The government of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region will actively adopt the information technology and build an e-government, a senior HK official said yesterday. This is an integral part of Hong Kong's Digital 21 strategy formulated in 1998 to make Hong Kong both a regional and worldwide internet center, said Carrie Yao, Secretary for Information Technology and Broadcasting. She outlined three policy objectives in developing an e-government in Hong Kong at the IBM Asian Pacific E-Government Executive Seminar. The first policy objective is to develop an electronic and paperless government so as to improve the efficiency, cost-effectiveness, and quality of public services. The second is to promote the wider adoption of e-commerce, with the government setting a leading example. The third is, through the e-government program, to integrate service delivery across multiple departments and agencies.
Questions 14 and 15 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 30 seconds to answer the questions. Now listen to the news. Canada's Olympic 100-meter champion, Donovan Bailey, showed he was on his way back to top form on Tuesday by winning the 100 meters at the athletic meet in Switzerland in a time of 9.98 seconds. Despite unfavorable wind conditions, Bailey recorded the second-best time of the year, short after 9.91 set by double world champion Morris Green of the United States on May 13th in Osaka, Japan. I would have run 9.8 if I really pushed myself, said Bailey, 1996 Olympic and 1995 world champion. The Canadian has been fighting for form before the Sydney Olympics, following a long-term injury which resulted in a disappointing series of starless seasons.
Section D, note-taking and gap-filling. In this section, you will hear a mini-lecture. You will hear the lecture once only. While listening to the lecture, take notes on the important points. Your notes will not be marked, but you will need them to complete a 15-minute gap-filling task on the answer sheet after the mini-lecture. Use the blank sheet for note-taking. Now, listen to the mini-lecture. Study activities in university. Good morning. Today, we'll look at some study activities carried out in the university. As we know, students in colleges or universities are expected to master some academic materials that are fairly difficult to understand. However, some of them find it hard to learn some complex, abstract, or unfamiliar subject matter. As a result, a central problem in higher education is how to internalize academic knowledge, that is, how to make knowledge your own. In order to do so, we must convert knowledge from being other people's knowledge to being part of your own ways of thinking. Then, how are we going to do it? And what are the means available to help us in the process of learning? There are four key study activities currently used in higher education to encourage students to internalize knowledge. They are the ones we are familiar with: writing essays, going to classes and seminars, having individual tutorials, and listening to lectures. These four activities are long-established features of our higher education, and they are almost as important now as they were 100 years ago. Now let's look at the features of them one by one. First, essay writing. The central focus of university work, especially in the humanities, for example, in literature, history, or politics, is on students producing regular essays and papers, which summarize and express their personal understanding of the topic. Then, what is good about essay writing? Firstly, writing essays forces you to select what you find interesting in books and journals, and to express your understanding in a coherent form.
Individual written work also provides teachers with the best available guide to how you are progressing in the subject and allows them to give advice on how to develop your strengths or counteract your weaknesses. Lastly, of course, individual written work is still the basis of almost all assessment in higher education. Written assignments familiarize you with the forms that your exams or coursework papers will take. The second key activity in colleges and universities is seminars and class discussions. Their role is to help you internalize academic knowledge by providing specialized contexts so that you can talk about such difficult problems as the trade-off between inflation and unemployment in economic policy, or the use of metaphors in Shakespeare's plays. Talking is a more interactive activity than written work. In the conversation, you know immediately how effectively you are expressing a viewpoint and can modify what you are saying in response to people's reactions. In addition, a normal program of between 10 and 25 classes will cover far more topics in one subject than you can hope to manage in your written work. Participating in flexible conversations across this range of issues also allows you to practice using the broad knowledge gained from other key activities as lecture. Now, let's take a look at another activity, individual tutorials. Discussions between a teacher and one or two students are used in many colleges as a substitute for or a supplement to group discussions in classes like those mentioned before. Tutorials can range from direct explanations by the teacher in the subject to flexible conversational sections which, at their best, are effective in stimulating students' mastery of the body of knowledge. One-to-one quality of the personal interaction is very important in stimulating acceptance of ideas and producing fruitful interaction. In order to make individual tutorials really work, the students should make good preparation beforehand and during the tutorial. They should also ask questions to keep the ball rolling, rather than let teachers talk in a vacuum. The last activity is lectures. As we all know, lectures play a large part in most students' timetables and occupy a considerable proportion of teachers' efforts. However, the major difficulty with lectures is that they are not interactive like discussions or tutorials. The lecturer normally talks for the whole time with minimal feedback questions. Besides, taking notes in lectures while concentrating on the argument being developed is often difficult to some students, especially when the argument is very complicated. However, having said that, lectures are clearly valuable in several specific ways. They can provide a useful overview, an area map, as it were, to familiarize you with the main landscape features to be encountered during a course. Lectures typically give much more accessible descriptions of theoretical perspectives in their oral presentations than can be found in the academic literature. Whenever there is a rapid pace of progress in theory or practice, lectures play an indispensable part in letting students know the development immediately, usually several years before the new material is included in textbooks. Lastly, lectures are often very useful in allowing you to see directly how exponents of different views build up their arguments. The cues provided by seeing someone talking in person may seem irrelevant, but these cues are important aids to understanding our subjects better later. So far, we've discussed four study activities and their respective features and roles in higher education. Of course, study activities are not limited to just these four types. There are other activities that are equally important, such as general reading, project learning, etc. We'll cover them during our next lecture. Now, you have 2 minutes to check your notes, and then please complete the 15-minute gap-filling task on the answer sheet. This is the end of listening comprehension.